capital raising. Deregulation gave birth to so-called one-stop shopping, with one bank or a small group handling every financial element of a merger or acquisition, from strategizing and crafting it to the underwriting and marketing of both loans and bonds. LBO sponsors, in particular, were elated to be rid of the hassle of scraping together debt from multiple sources. But the new full-service banks siphoned off advisory work from boutique advisors, such as Blackstone, that didn't lend or underwrite. A few long-established M&A boutiques, such as Lazard Frere, maintained strong franchises as pure advisors. Wasserstein Perella, an M&A-come-private equity shop like Blackstone, also pulled in big fees. But Blackstone's M&A group struggled, and it was a sore point with Schwartzman. Whenever a plum assignment fell through or anything bad happened, he would erupt. Schwartzman often would vent his fury at Hoffman, a former Smith Barney M&A executive who had been at Blackstone since 1989. The animosity between Michael and Steve was unbelievable. You've got to give Michael credit. He endured it all. Every day, it seemed, he got dumped on, recalls one ex-partner. What galled Schwartzman most, says Hoffman, was the fact that Bruce Wasserstein, his old rival, was eating Blackstone's lunch in M&A. "I thought we did well, considering the obstacles," Hoffman says. According to Hoffman, Blackstone's yearly M&A fees nearly tripled during the 1990s, rising from $25 million early in the decade to $70 million. Still, that was less than one-fifth the $400 million that Wasserstein Perella pulled in. Schwartzman dumped on the fact that the M&A business was not as big as Wasserstein's, Hoffman says. Hoffman's unit turned a fair profit, but that fact didn't placate Schwartzman, he says. Hoffman left in 2001 to advise the state of California on a financial crisis, and later moved to Riverstone Holdings, a private equity firm that specializes in energy investments. Hill eventually would excel and leave a lasting mark at the firm, but not in M&A. By the mid-90s, Blackstone's hedge fund of funds business, which David Batten had conceived in 1990 to invest the money Blackstone had received from NICO, was managing money from outside investors, charging them a fee to screen hedge funds and spread their money across a variety of funds, and had become a profit-making business in its own right. Called Blackstone Alternative Asset Management, BAM for short, the unit would scuffle along under a series of overseers until the time Hill relinquished his M&A post and took charge of it in 2000. At BAM, Hill would find his groove, and the business's assets under management would soar in size. Chapter 12. Back in Business. The resuscitation of the buyout market was nothing like the violent crash that preceded it. There was no one deal that announced private equity was back in business. No clarion sounded. Instead, it was a gradual thaw. The junk bond market experienced a revival in 1992 and 1993, as Donaldson, Lufkin, and Jenrette and other banks hired the best and the brightest out of Drexel Burnham after it went under in 1990 and put them to work. But little of the money raised via junk bonds was being used to finance new buyouts. LBO was still a dirty word. It was clear that the free-handed lending practices of the 80s were obsolete. Scarred by the failures of scores of businesses they'd helped lever to the hilt, the Wall Street banks wised up, imposing a stricter lending regimen. Unlike the old days, when buyout sponsors could get away with inserting a mere sliver of equity, 10% or less of the purchase price, lenders now demanded that they have much more at risk. From 1993 through the early 2000s, lenders almost always demanded at least 20%, and often 30% of the cost to be financed with equity. That forced a new calculus on the LBO set. No longer could they take control of massive enterprises with a smidgen of their own money, as KKR had done with RJR and Beatrice. With less debt for the same quantum of equity, the average size of LBOs inevitably shrank. With less leverage, sponsors were also staring at lower returns because minute gains in a company's value could no longer be multiplied 10 or 20 times. The only good news was that the price tags for companies came down. In the new environment, buyout firms were forced to re-examine how they went about making profits and what the LBO game was all about. Slowly, they began to focus more on making operational improvements at their companies. Where they had once simply slashed costs and sold off assets whose value was masked inside a larger enterprise, they began focusing on the top line, revenue. They began asking how they might alter a company's mix of profits to emphasize higher margin items, how they might expand its geographic reach or fill in gaps through acquisitions, or how they might improve relations with customers. A few, like Clayton Dubilier and Rice, built up stables of executives they could parachute in to help reform the companies the firm bought. CD&R showcased its approach with an ambitious carve-out of IBM's office product lines in 1991. No office products division existed when IBM approached CD&R about taking on the assets. It was just a mismatch of slow-growth or dying products, such as Selectric typewriters and dot matrix printers, that IBM sought to sell. CD&R would have to create a company around them, and then take on bigger, more nimble competitors, such as Hewlett-Packard, that dominated the inkjet printer business. It was a tall order, something other buyout firms would never attempt. But CD&R succeeded, building the IBM cast-offs into a new company called Lexmark, accelerating product development and shaping it into a serious competitor in inkjet and laser printers before taking it public in 1995. CD&R claims that when its partners first met with IBM chairman John Akers, he brandished a copy of Barbarians at the Gate and said, "The reason I am talking with you is because you are not mentioned in this book." KKR had undertaken ambitious overhauls such as Safeways, but few firms had experience with this sort of hands-on investing. It was an approach they would increasingly come to emulate, or, at the least, pay lip service to. The new emphasis on value building was accompanied by a new terminology. LBO and buyout had become so tarnished that buyout firms started branding what they did as private equity. British buyout firms, meanwhile, took to calling their deals management buyouts, to highlight that the business would be run by familiar faces, though the manager seldom had a controlling stake. Private equity had long been used for venture capital investments in startups and other young companies, an investment approach that was widely lauded as fueling innovation and growth. But now the phrase was appropriated for the more controversial process of buying companies with borrowed money. The new term took hold, but it did little to free the buyout business from the stigma of its signature deals in the 80s. In its new incarnation, with less leverage, more equity, and more prudence, the buyout business began to emerge from hibernation in 1993 and 1994. The stock markets were still traveling sideways, but the economy was climbing out of the 1991-92 slump. It proved to be a fantastic time to invest. In the 4 years after the CNW deal closed in late 1989, Blackstone had pulled off only three sizable buyouts: Hospitality Franchise Systems, Six Flags, and Great Lakes Dredge and Dock Company, a Chicago dredging contractor it bought for $177 million in October 1991. But in late 1994, it returned to the hunt and lined up two new investments: a tiny wager on a broadcaster, U.S. Radio, and a big bet on steel. The latter, like Blackstone's maiden investment in iron ore and steel hauler Transtar, would yield a stratospheric return. Just as Blackstone had parlayed its success with Transtar into a bigger second fund, the $1.2 billion purchase of UCAR International, Incorporated, laid the groundwork for its third fund and Blackstone's ascendancy in the late 90s. UCAR, a joint venture of Union Carbide and Japan's Mitsubishi Corporation, wasn't itself a steelmaker, but was the world's largest maker of graphite electrodes used to produce steel. Thick rods that, when heated to 5,000 degrees Fahrenheit and dipped into cauldrons big enough to digest a house, could melt scrap metal into liquid steel. Because the rods had to be replaced often, UCAR was guaranteed a steady stream of orders so long as demand for steel held fast. But what particularly enthralled Blackstone was the fact that UCAR and its main competitor, Germany's SGL Group, had slashed manufacturing capacity by about a third over the previous decade, while aggressively boosting prices. David Stockman came up with an analysis showing that the price of electrodes was going up because there was no capacity left anywhere, says Howard Lifson. He understood the business, had analyzed it in terms of the end markets and capacity. His analysis got us comfortable to do the deal. By the time Blackstone set its sights on UCAR, its owners were just weeks away from taking the business public, and Blackstone had to race to preempt the IPO. Pete Peterson, who in 1991 had advised Union Carbide Chief Executive Bob Kennedy when it sold half of UCAR to Mitsubishi, reached out to his old friend about selling UCAR to Blackstone instead of taking it public. IPOs are inherently risky because the offering price can change up to the last minute, and the seller can rarely sell more than a small minority of its shares at the outset. By contrast, a negotiated sale offers certainty and nets more cash for the seller, because it can offload as much of its holding as it wants. Peterson suggested that Union Carbide might want to retain a minority stake in case the company did well. I told him it made sense to own some of it, because if we made a big profit on it, he wouldn't look dumb the way RCA did after it sold Gibson Greeting to Westray, he says. Peterson sold Kennedy on the concept, but it was Chemical Bank's Jimmy Lee who made the deal fly. Working against the ticking IPO clock, Lee took a gamble no commercial bank had ever taken before, offering to arrange not only the loans for the buyout, but also junk bond financing. It was a first, and a sign of how the once sharp line between the securities business of the investment banks and lending by the commercial banks was fading. Lee added another sweetener as well by putting Chemical's guarantee behind the entire $1.1 billion financing package. "The only way we're going to talk Bob Kennedy out of taking it public is if we give them certainty of financing," Schwartzman told Lee. "You want to lead a big high-yield deal? Here is your chance." Lee was petrified. If he couldn't syndicate the loans or sell the bonds, and Chemical had to make good on the bridge financing, the bank would face far more exposure to a single company than it would ever ordinarily take. "We had never done a bridge of this size before, and I knew that if I took the bridge down and couldn't sell the bonds, I'd be gone, vaporized. Jimmy Lee would be toast, and maybe chemical, too. Schwartzman eased Lee's fears by assuring him that if chemical had to fund the bridge, we'd be in it together, Lee says. Though Schwartzman didn't spell out specifics, he seemed to imply that if the need arose, Blackstone might cough up more money to buy bonds or agree to concessions on the bridge loan. Those were the magic words I needed to hear, says Lee. He was reassured, too, because he knew that Schwartzman had a vested interest in supporting chemical. He knew that if he could get me to be a major player in high-yield bonds, he would gain leverage against other private equity firms. With chemical in its corner, Blackstone would have an easier time trumping them in bidding contests. The deal was signed in November 1994 and sealed 2 months later. Blackstone invested $187 million for 75%, taking half of Union Carbide's stake and all of Mitsubishi's. UCAR proved to be a watershed for Wall Street. Lee's successful junk bond offering for the buyout marked the birth of one-stop financing for large LBOs, a market that a small circle of banks led by Chemical Bank and its successor, J.P. Morgan Chase, came to dominate. Lee had first concocted the debt syndication model that transformed commercial banks from lenders into debt distribution platforms, carving up loans and selling them to a multitude of investors, mutual funds, hedge funds, and the like. Now, he had conjoined the lending and bond issuing process under one roof. Lee's debt syndication machine would evolve into a font of profits for Chemical and other Wall Street banks. Now they could manage huge debt financings and rake off fees without packing their own books with risky loans. The market the banks built attracted a flood of capital from non-traditional lenders, such as hedge funds, which triggered a surge in buyout activity and allowed larger and larger deals to be financed. By the late 1990s, loan syndications, including corporate loans not tied to buyouts, were a $1 trillion-plus business, with Lee's group at Chase handling a third of that. In the 2000s, the one-stop financing and syndication model would funnel hundreds of billions of dollars into LBOs and set off a wave of record-shattering megadeals. As much as any single figure on Wall Street, Jimmy Lee set the stage for the great leveraged buyout extravaganza of 2005 to 2007. UCAR was also a grand slam for Blackstone. The spring and summer after the investment was made, production cuts and price hikes drove up UCAR's earnings, and in August 1995, the owners moved to cash in by taking UCAR public. When Blackstone sold the last of its shares in April 1997, after a surge in the stock, it had bagged a whopping $675 million gain, 3.6 times its investment, and an average annual return of close to 200%. That day at 345 Park Avenue, spirits ran high. But a cloud soon would be cast over the UCAR investment. On June 5th, less than 2 months after Blackstone had cashed out, federal investigators subpoenaed UCAR as part of a price-fixing investigation. In March 1998, UCAR threw out its chairman and CEO, Robert Crass, and its COO, Robert Hart, and in April 1998, it pleaded guilty to antitrust violations and agreed to pay the U.S. government a $110 million fine. Crass and Hart were packed off to prison. The production cuts and ensuing price hikes that had so captivated Stockman when he was first analyzing the company as a prospect, and which were the basis for much of UCAR's growth, turned out to have been the fruit of illegal collusion. Starting in 1992, before Blackstone acquired UCAR, the company and its chief rival, SGL, which together controlled two-thirds of the world market in graphite rods, had conspired to cut capacity in tandem. At least one Blackstone partner, Lipson, was questioned in the cases against Crass and Hart, but no one from Blackstone, Union Carbide, or Mitsubishi was ever charged. Says Lipson, "What we didn't know, and what you learn, is that many price-fixing schemes involve capacity-fixing schemes. It was a shock." Fortunately, Blackstone had most of the commitments for its third buyout fund, Blackstone Capital Partners III, signed up by that summer, before the UCAR scandal fully unfolded. To investors, the stupendous profit on Blackstone's huge investment in UCAR was a mighty draw. Nearly all the 80% annualized return that Blackstone touted to investors was attributable to UCAR. It was a pattern that would recur with future funds. One or two great investments made at a trough in the business cycle could make a fund a huge success. The $4 billion third buyout fund, which had its final closing in October 1997, elevated Blackstone to the number two position in private equity. Only KKR, the industry's perennial kingpin, boasted a larger fund, a $5.7 billion vehicle raised in 1996. Forstmann Little, long KKR's leading competitor, had rounded up just $3.2 billion in 1997 for its latest fund. The other mega funds of the period were all a safe distance behind. A $3 billion pool at Donaldson, Lufkin, and Jenrette's private equity unit, Welsh, Carson, Anderson, and Stowe's $3.2 billion, and Thomas H. Lee Company's $3.5 billion. Not until 1999, when Tom Hicks and John Muse's firm, which now was called Hicks, Muse, Tate, and First, closed on $4.1 billion, did anyone edge ahead of Blackstone. With the new fund, Blackstone was no longer an aspiring upstart. It now was a player, and Schwartzman wasn't shy about broadcasting the firm's success. In an April 1998 interview with Business Week, he drew the reporter's attention to Blackstone's complement of advisory, hedge fund, real estate, and buyout activities. By contrast, he said dismissively, KKR was a one-trick pony. If there had been any doubt that Schwartzman was vying to steal Kravis's crown as the king of private equity, the put-down laid that to rest. But the glow of triumph from UCAR and the new fund soon dissipated. Blackstone did make a handful of good investments in 1997 and 1998. Stockman's bet on transmission maker American Axle and Manufacturing, along with three telecom investments led by the up-and-coming partner, Mark Gologli. But many of the deals it struck in those years turned into clunkers. A funeral home and cemetery investment was a wipeout. Blackstone paid an inflated 14 times cash flow for Prime Succession and Rose Hills, which it bought in partnership with the funeral industry giant, Loewen Group, just as the funeral business was turning down. Blackstone had negotiated downside protection in the form of a put option that allowed it to sell its stake back to Loewen at a gain. But just when Prime Succession and Rose Hills were on the brink of insolvency, Loewen itself was teetering on the edge, succumbing to the industry's general malaise and a huge court judgment. Loewen filed for bankruptcy in 1999, rendering the put option worthless. Blackstone walked away $58 million poorer. Adding insult to injury, as Loewen was failing, Blackstone was fined $2.8 million for not disclosing to antitrust regulators an internal document when it sought clearance to buy Prime Succession in 1996. The document highlighted that Loewen and Prime were competitors, Howard Lipson, who had certified to the government that Blackstone's application was complete, was personally fined $50,000. Blackstone lavished a total of $441 million from its second and third funds on Allied Waste Industries, a trash hauler, landfill owner, and recycler, in 1997 and 1990. Up to then, the most Blackstone had injected into one company. But the main premise of the investment proved to be flat wrong. Blackstone and Allied executives had predicted that a dwindling supply of unused landfill would jack up prices. Instead, a brutal price war erupted. More than 10 years later, Blackstone was still sitting on its stake. "We preserved capital, but it was dead money," says Lipson, who led the deal. Schwartzman can still painfully tick off the names of other late-90s Blackstone duds. Haynes International, a producer of aerospace alloys, plastic bottle maker Graham Packaging, and the ostentatiously named Imperial Home Decor, the world's biggest wallpaper maker. Haynes and Imperial, both Stockman deals, eventually went bankrupt, socking Blackstone with $127 million in losses. Graham, another Lipson deal, survived but struggled. A strategic merger with another packaging company that Blackstone financed in the hopes of boosting Graham's market share utterly backfired. Some of Graham's main customers, food and beverage companies, were unnerved by the prospect of being too dependent on one company and took business elsewhere. Graham, like Allied Waste, would languish on Blackstone's list of holdings for more than a decade after the original investment, an eternity in the private equity business. With hindsight, there was a pattern to the failures. All were highly cyclical companies whose fortune seesawed with the economy. None were dominant or even terribly competitive in their fields. In some cases, the opposite was true. The businesses had intractable problems that made it impossible for them to gain traction against bigger and stronger rivals. No one inside Blackstone really understood the businesses that well. On top of all that, Blackstone bought many of them at the wrong time in the economic cycle. It wound up overpaying and piling on too much debt. It had stacked the deck against itself. These were all medium-sized cyclical businesses that we bought within 2 or 3 years of an economic top, says Schwartzman. We paid too much for some of them. We had ambitious turnaround plans for them that turned out to be very difficult to execute. The losses taught the firm several lessons, he says. First, don't pay too much when you're buying cyclicals, he says. Second, don't have ambitious turnaround expectations for medium-sized companies. Don't expect to reinvent them. Third, if an investment calls for re-engineering operations, don't have it be a Blackstone manufactured plan. Rather, develop a plan in consultation with seasoned executives and consultants knowledgeable enough to judge if the plan will fly. Several of Blackstone's debacles had something else in common. They had been championed and overseen by David Stockman, whose Midwestern roots had instilled in him a zeal for rejuvenating Rust Belt businesses. His 11-year career at the firm had been remarkably checkered. His conviction in 1997 that demand for sport utility vehicles would continue to soar led the firm in 1997 to buy American Axle, a spin-off of General Motors that specialized in drivetrains for SUVs. When the company went public in January 1999, a little over a year after Blackstone bought it, the market valued American Axle at 4 times Blackstone's cost. But such hits were proving to be the exception, not the rule, and by the summer of 1999, Stockman's stock inside Blackstone had reached bottom. The SUV thesis tied in with the premise of another 1997 investment in Premcor USA, an oil refiner that was as problematic as American Axle was successful. When oil prices dropped in 1997 and 1998 because of oversupply, Premcor was stuck with old inventory it had bought at higher prices, and its earnings turned negative. When oil prices rose again several years later, Stockman's belief that there would be a shortage of refining capacity was vindicated. But in 1999, it looked like another of his ornately argued investments had backfired. At Haynes, which made alloy parts for planes and chemical refineries, his projections proved too rosy, and by 1999 the company was headed toward bankruptcy. The story with Imperial Home Decor was equally disastrous, but more comical. When Blackstone invested in 1998, Stockman projected big sales gains in post-Soviet Russia and Eastern Europe as incomes there rose. A young banker who worked on the original deal recalls Stockman explaining how people there would need wallpaper to cover up cracking plaster that was beyond painting. Not only did that seem far-fetched, to the 20-something banker, just a year or two out of business school, wallpaper seemed passé. "I'm thinking, what do I know?" he says. "But I don't know anyone who buys wallpaper." He was right. When Russia defaulted on its debt in 1998, the Eastern European economies sank, and global wallpaper sales fell 10 to 15%. Sales in Western Europe and the United States remained anemic, and the company resorted to bankruptcy in January 2000 to rid itself of its debt, taking $84.5 million of Blackstone's money with it. Then there was Republic Technologies International, a much grander fiasco. Stockman had hatched a scheme to create a money-making specialty steel business out of unwanted subsidiaries of bigger steelmakers. He began his buying spree in April 1996 with a $30 million purchase of Bar Technologies, the former wire and rod division of Bethlehem Steel, and later annexed two much bigger businesses, Republic Engineering Steels and a steel bar venture once owned by U.S. Steel and Japan's Kobe Steel. When Bar Technologies merged with Republic in 1998, the businesses were in such rotten shape that one Wall Street wag likened the combination to two garbage trucks in a collision. Stockman's plan was to shutter plants and lay off thousands of workers, which he did. But the price of union cooperation was an agreement to pay $178 million into the union pension plan. When the drastic downsizing didn't produce the profits Stockman had forecast, the company found itself burdened with the pension liability and began to hemorrhage cash. The pension payout sucked it dry of liquidity, says a person who was involved in the deal. The Kobe U.S. Steel deal really killed the company. It was the bridge too far. In 1999, Republic was barely clinging to life, though it would be two more years before it declared bankruptcy. Blackstone sank $190 million into Republic, the biggest investment in Blackstone's second buyout fund. The whole investment would go up in smoke. In addition to the stream of worrying financial news from Stockman's portfolio, complaints about Stockman were filtering back to others at Blackstone, from the managers of the companies, who were unhappy at his persistent meddling and niggling. Stockman questioned the judgment of executives who knew their businesses far better than he, and his suggestions sometimes seemed off the wall. In August 1999, when Stockman was away on a two-week African vacation, Schwartzman decided to play detective. He personally hit the phones, calling executives at each of Stockman's companies to find out about their relations with Stockman. From those soundings, Steve came to the realization that David was a little out of control, says a former associate. When Stockman returned, Schwartzman told him that he had in mind a new role for him, spotting trends and researching potential investments. His days overseeing companies, he was informed, were over. Stockman was not booted out, but he could see that his role would be diminished. On September 16, 1999, he announced he was quitting Blackstone to form his own private equity firm, Heartland Industrial Partners. In a press release, Schwartzman and Peterson extolled his fine work on American Axle. Blackstone invested some of its own capital in Heartland, and Peterson served on Heartland's board of advisors. The parting was smooth enough that even years later, Stockman would still periodically drop by Blackstone's offices. But few, if any, of his Blackstone colleagues were sorry to see him go. At Heartland, Stockman was free to pursue his convictions unchecked, and he poured his investors' money into Midwestern manufacturers, many linked to the auto industry. Nearly all went bust. The most disastrous was an investment in the auto interiors and trims company that had launched his private equity career in 1998, Collins and Aikman, nay, Wicks, and that continued to hold an allure for him. Less than 2 years after he founded Heartland, he bought control of Collins and Aikman from Blackstone and Wasserstein and Company, which had taken the company public in 1994, but had never managed to cash out. After a dozen years, they were only too happy to get out, even though they recouped less than half their original money. Stockman appended other smaller parts makers to Collins and Aikman, but by 2003 it was being squeezed by rising raw materials prices and falling profits at its customers, General Motors, Ford, and Chrysler. Stockman personally took the helm as CEO in 2003, but the company was taking on water, and he could not keep it from sinking under the weight of the debt from its buyout and the acquisitions. In 2005, Collins and Aikman filed for bankruptcy, obliterating Heartland's $360 million investment. In 2007, Stockman was indicted on charges of hiding Collins and Aikman's true financial condition from investors, while its situation turned dire. 2 long years later, federal prosecutors dropped the charges, saying that further prosecution of this case would not be in the interests of justice. But by then, the one-time Wunderkind's reputation as an astute wheeler and dealer in private equity lay in tatters. Chapter 13. Tuning in Profits. So long as you didn't cast your gaze too far beyond the center of the financial universe in Manhattan, Blackstone seemed to be enjoying a golden era in the late 90s. On the back of the spectacular profits of its second fund from 1992, it raised a new $4 billion investment pool in 1998. The world's largest insurance company, American International Group, took a 7% stake in the firm, valuing Blackstone at $2.1 billion, and AIG promised to ante up $1.2 billion for Blackstone's investment funds. Forbes and Business Week each ran cover stories proclaiming the resurgence of leveraged buyouts. But the truth was, by then, Blackstone and private equity were a sideshow. The prosaic cash-generating businesses that traditionally had been the bread and butter of the private equity business, short-line railroads like Transtar, graphite makers like UCAR, and auto parts makers like Collins and Aikman and American Axle, had fallen out of fashion. The old economy of boring, profitable, but slow and steady companies was being eclipsed by the high-tech, new economy. The IPO of Netscape Communications in April 1995 is usually pegged as the turning point. At the time, the Internet was still in its infancy. For most people, it meant email and perhaps some America Online chat rooms. Netscape's browser, which the company gave away free, enabled a new generation of websites loaded with photos and snappy typefaces, and introduced a generation to what many still called by its formal name, the World Wide Web. For Netscape's founders, the company was more than just a software business. They were on a mission to democratize information via the Internet, and they sold the public on the proposition, literally. The company went public at $28 per share, valuing the startup at $1.1 billion. Investors who hadn't been able to buy shares in the IPO itself were so desperate to get a piece of the action that they drove the stock up to $75 on its first day of trading. To the cash flow-obsessed private equity mind, and frankly, under any conventional form of economic analysis, the price was absurd. Netscape had taken in just $16.6 million in revenue in the previous 6 months and lost $4.3 million in the process. The IPO demonstrated just how hungry investors were for startups that promised to remake the world with their technology and prepared the way for a new era of investing. The next year, Yahoo, the web portal and search engine, followed in Netscape's footsteps, going public at a similar valuation, despite revenues of just $1.4 million and a loss of nearly half that. Make money? That was so old economy. There was no need to do that now. The mere prospect of huge profits down the road was enough to lure the public. Instead of profits, the financial metric became burn rate, how much of its backers' cash a company chewed through every month or year. However fantastical the stock prices were, a profound technological revolution was in fact underway. Advances in personal computers and access to online information made workers more productive and created new pastimes. That in turn drove demand for more telecommunication services, which created a demand for new phone switching equipment and the software to go with it, which allowed more and more information and graphics to be moved across the Internet, in turn spawning the birth of new Internet businesses. Completing the virtuous circle, this led people to want more powerful computers and even faster connections to the Internet. Private equity firms like Blackstone found themselves looking on from the sidelines of the revolution. The stratospheric profits from the IPOs of companies like Netscape, Yahoo, Amazon.com, and eBay were flowing into the pockets of entrepreneurs and the venture capitalists who backed them. Those windfalls inevitably had a profound impact on buyout firms. Profound and disastrous in some cases. Venture capital funds share the same legal structures as buyout funds. They are limited partnerships, and their sponsors typically collect 1.5% or 2% a year as a management fee and 20% of investment profits. They tap the same pension funds, endowments, and other institutions for money. But there, the similarities end. The programmers, chipmakers, biotech researchers, internet merchants, and the venture capitalists, or VCs, who financed them, operated in their own universe, on another coast, playing by their own set of rules. The epicenter of the U.S. buyout industry is Midtown Manhattan, where Blackstone, KKR, Apollo, Warburg Pincus, and dozens of other firms are headquartered, within a few blocks of one another in a world of starched shirts and Hermes ties, chauffeured Mercedes, and office towers. Ground zero of the venture world is Sand Hill Road, a landscaped boulevard rising into the gentle suburban hills behind Palo Alto, California. There, capital flows in a dressed-down world of khakis and golf shirts, low-rise office compounds surrounded by groves of live oaks and towering eucalyptuses. Venture capitalists drive themselves to work in Ferraris and Porsches. The investment styles were as different as the dress codes. Venture investing involves an entirely different type of risk. VCs seed scores of small companies that often have little or no revenue, and many of those that do take in revenue are nonetheless losing money. No bank would lend to these businesses, but they need equity capital for research and to build out their businesses. The VCs know that many of their companies will fizzle, but hope that a few will be spectacularly successful. It is a scattershot approach, like tossing apple seeds and hoping a healthy tree or two will spring up. VCs make bets on which entrepreneur will achieve a technological breakthrough first, who can get to market fastest, and whose product will dominate its market, events whose likelihood defies precise projections. This is a world away from buyouts. If venture investing is a game of long, daring passes, many incomplete, the LBO game is fought a yard at a time on the ground. To be a private equity investor, you need to be a kind of control freak, someone who can patiently map out all the scenarios, good and bad, first to make sure your company won't go bust, and second to see how it can be improved incrementally to lift its value. Buyout investing focuses on cash flow because banks won't lend money and bond buyers won't buy bonds unless they are confident a company will be able to pay its creditors through thick and thin. Private equity investing means burrowing into businesses and performing minutely tuned analyses. Could revenue be boosted a point or two? How much would pass through to the bottom line? What costs could be taken out to notch up the profit margin a fraction? Could we shave a quarter of a point off the interest rate on the debt? If the company has problems, how much of a cushion is there before it defaults? If private equity investors do their job right, things more often than not will play out more or less in line with their projections. Because venture investments are so much more unpredictable, venture investing requires a degree of passion, a belief in the product and its potential, and very often in its value to society. Venture capitalists talk of nurturing disruptive technologies that will upend existing industries and lay the groundwork for new ones, in the way that diesel locomotives displaced steam engines, personal computers and laser and inkjet printers rendered the typewriter obsolete, and digital photography supplanted film. No amount of number crunching can predict if a new website will capture the public's imagination or whether a biotech startup's research will succeed in developing a drug to treat cancer. The payoff comes from seeding dozens of long shots. To sustain the process, the VCs and the entrepreneurs they back have to believe. And during the boom of the 1990s, they had that faith in spades. The buyout types, with their dense spreadsheets and elaborately engineered debt structures, never promised to transform the world. They had no religion to offer the investing masses. The passion for the new technology became contagious in the second half of the 1990s and began to alter the calculus for buyout firms far removed from Silicon Valley, as capital that might have gone to LBO funds began flowing into venture funds. Executives and business school graduates, too, were gravitating to tech companies, hoping to be paid in stock so they could make a fortune when the companies went public. Blackstone wasn't equipped to compete on the VC's home turf in pure technology plays, but Mark Gologly, the youngest deal-making partner in the buyout group, succeeded, partly by accident, in riding the internet wave. Galogli was the odd one out among the larger-than-life personalities and egos there. He generated none of the electricity that the brilliant and overbearing David Stockman did. He had a penchant for analysis, but he was not an eccentric mad scientist number grinder like James Mossman, nor could he compete for laughs with the outgoing, wisecracking Howie Lipson. Galogli, who began his career on the lending side at Manufacturers Hanover Bank, was intense, reserved, and soft-spoken. Innately cautious, he retained a loan officer's fear of risk, measuring his words and agonizing over investments. Inside the firm, he was seen as a good investor, collegial, and uncommonly concerned about morale. In a firm that was notoriously hard on junior employees, it was Galogli who hosted summer parties at his house in Rhode Island and organized the annual firm ski outing. He even lobbied once to install a plaque in the lobby, inscribed with the name of every young analyst who had ever warmed a cubicle seat at Blackstone. The proposal went nowhere. Galogli became intrigued by the cable TV industry in the mid-1990s and had his underlings running numbers. At the time, the business was beaten down. Customers were up in arms about rising rates, which politicians and regulators were threatening to rein in, and cable operators, which had long enjoyed monopolies in their territories, suddenly faced a new threat from satellite TV. They were calling it the Death Star. Satellite was going to kill cable, says Blackstone partner Lawrence Guffey, who worked as an associate for Galogli at the time. Galogli thought the market had overreacted. Rural cable systems in particular looked like prime LBO material, with solid cash flows and very little threat of competition. The first deal that came to fruition was a classic Blackstone corporate partnership. The cable subsidiary of Time Warner, the media conglomerate, was planning to merge some of its marginal rural cable systems with others run by Bob Fanch, a veteran cable executive whom Galogli's team had cultivated. Blackstone already had ties to Time Warner through the Six Flags theme park's investment in 1991, and offered to come to its aid again with the cable subsidiary. Blackstone invested $50 million for a one-half interest in the merged Time Warner-Fanch system, which covered parts of Pennsylvania, West Virginia, Texas, Ohio, and North Carolina. The business then borrowed so that debt could replace some of Time Warner's equity, allowing Time Warner to take out cash. As a bonus, because it no longer held a controlling stake, Time Warner no longer had to report the system's debt on its own balance sheet, which was massively leveraged at the time. Much of the combined network, which was dubbed TW Fanch 1, was antiquated, transmitting as few as 30 channels. The plan was to update it to offer more programming, much of it to be provided by Time Warner at advantageous rates, and convince customers to pay up for more channels. In some cases, the systems were quite primitive, says Galogli. We believed the business had real growth potential, both through price and through improved technology. Even if satellite TV took a greater share than we were expecting, the cable business was generating a lot of cash flow, and we thought we could do well despite that. What happened next was not in the business plan, but it was extraordinarily fortunate. When the deal closed in 1996, most people who used the Internet dialed in on their regular phone lines to America Online, CompuServe, or another Internet provider. But as websites developed richer and richer content, and it became possible to move images and other large files over the Internet, conventional phone connections were painfully slow, and computer users demanded high-speed data hookups. cable companies, whose video transmission networks already had enormous bandwidth, the capacity to send heavy streams of electronic signals, found they could easily adapt their systems to carry phone calls and internet traffic. In fact, they could modify their systems to offer high-speed internet access more easily than traditional phone companies could. We didn't know in 1996 that the internet was going to be a boom, but we knew that we would be able to benefit from the fact that we'd be one of only two direct lines into the home, Gologli says. Offering internet and phone service was icing on the cake. Gologli soon engineered a second deal combining other Time Warner and Fanch systems and invested in two unrelated companies, Intermedia Partners 6 and Bresnan Communications Incorporated, that were buying stakes in rural cable systems owned by Telecommunications Incorporated, one of Time Warner's big national cable rivals. By that point, the cable industry, which had been all but written off only a few years earlier, had become a crucial link in the internet, and triple play, phone, internet, and cable over the same connection, was the buzz in the telecom industry. The industry had also acquired its own high priest of triple play, Paul Allen, the co-founder of Microsoft Corporation. The billionaire combined the faith of a tech maven with a personal fortune of some $20 billion to back his dream of becoming a cable mogul of the first order. Beginning in 1998 with the purchase of a small cable business, Charter Communications, Allen went on a 3-year shopping spree, leveraging Charter to the hilt and shelling out $24.6 billion to buy 20 cable systems. Soon he came knocking on Blackstone's door. Blackstone and Time Warner had assumed that Time Warner would one day buy back control of their systems, but in late 1999, Charter dropped a $2.4 billion offer on them for the two TW Fanch operations, an offer the two simply couldn't refuse. Charter soon bought Blackstone's Intermedia systems as well, and in February 2000, just a year after Blackstone had invested in Bresnan, Charter snatched that up, too, for $3.1 billion. Convinced that new technology would drive demand for his cutting-edge networks, Allen paid an eye-popping $4,500 per customer for the TW Fanch networks and $4,400 for Intermedia, about twice the price Blackstone had paid just a couple of years earlier. Paul Allen seemed to believe at the time that there was a cure for cancer coming down the cable pipeline, says Simon Lonergan, then an associate who worked with Gologli on the investments. We couldn't believe the prices he was paying for those assets. It was hard to have a rational view that justified paying that amount of money for infrastructure. We used to get up every morning and thank Paul Allen, says Brett Perlman, who worked on the Intermedia deal and became a partner in 2000, as Charter was forking over billions to Blackstone. Hallelujah! In fact, the prices did not make a lot of sense. 2 years later, Charter was near bankruptcy. It finally succumbed in the next recession in 2009. But Allen's folly was Blackstone's gain in 2000, and it walked away with $400 million, 8 times its original investment, on TW Fanch 1, a bigger multiple of its investment than even UCAR had earned. It hauled 5.5 times its money, or $747 million, on Bresnan. On top of the cable deals, Gologli logged another huge gain on a cell phone operator in Montana, Wyoming, the Dakotas, and Colorado. Like the cable systems, Blackstone was able to pick up ComNet Cellular cheaply in 1998 because its stock price was depressed owing to fears that new competitors would enter its markets. Gologli was skeptical, calculating that it would not be economical to build new cell networks in ComNet's sparsely populated territories. In 1999, less than a year and a half after Blackstone completed the purchase, Vodafone AirTouch, an emerging national firm that had bought a cell operator in the Denver area,